It's time for Agriculture, presented by Turkana Farms in Germantown, New York, a small-scale producer of heritage breed livestock and a wide array of vegetables and berries on just over 39 acres. They also produce a full array of garden vegetables, many of them heirloom varieties raised naturally, as well as an assortment of berries, including raspberries, blackberries, gooseberries, black, red, and white currants, mulberries, and elderberries. And now, here's Mark Scherzer.
A friend this week invited me to attend a lecture at the Albertine Bookstore in New York. The topic was a post-work world, and the advertised premise was that we must begin to come to terms with living in a world in which one's value in society is not measured by what one produces, because human productivity has been replaced by computers and machines, but by some other yardstick. I'm not a big lecture-goer, but as someone who has spent the last 17 or so years participating in a two-person back-to-the-land movement, where we measure our own worth by what we could physically produce of a very basic commodity, foodstuffs, I found the premise pretty intriguing. Am I moving backward as the world moves forward? I expected to be confronted with an existential dilemma. As it turned out, the distinguished panel discussing the topic didn't really seem to think that physical labor was going to disappear entirely. They did seem to agree that further developments in artificial intelligence, up to and including computers with emotions and ambitions, would require even fewer workers to produce all the commodities and goods required for a population of billions, so much so that work itself would become a scarce commodity, sought after by many. As more workers compete for smaller and smaller pool of jobs, and the fulfillment and sense of self-worth that comes with having such jobs, such competition could potentially lead to further impoverishment of those who perform such necessary labor. Hence, we've seen depressed wages persist in our own economy, even in an economic recovery. Our economic system, left to its own dynamic, concentrates ever greater wealth in those like the Gates and the Zuckerbergs who create the labor-saving tools and devices, while potentially impoverishing the masses of excess workers whose labor has been saved. It was how to avoid the consequences of this concentration of wealth that the panelists mostly addressed. When the goods produced by an individual no longer matter so much to the survival of the species, one has to find another way to allocate resources among us. And rather than pick other characteristics by which to assign people relative social value and rewards, these panelists turn to a concept of guaranteeing everyone, each of us being no less valuable than anyone else, a universally dignified standard of living, no matter what they do or do not do to earn it, a universal basic income. This concept was easy for me to accept, as I have for some years now advocated that small-scale farming be preserved through public subsidies. Instead of paying people the same price that would be paid for a product produced by a machine, assuming the value is in the thing produced, pay them an amount which enables them to keep producing it in their comparatively inefficient way. This seems to be what France and Japan do with their farm sectors in different ways. The purpose is not about most effectively producing enough nutrition to feed the population. Supporting artisanal production is instead a way of keeping alive a way of life which preserves other values. Species preservation, low environmental impact, a slower agrarian lifestyle. It's no accident that one panelist identified older peasant farmers and young artists as the population segments most enthusiastic about universal basic income. How nice to know that advocating support for small-scale farming, I was not really as backward-looking as I feared. I was instead in sync with a future vision that would recognize the inherent dignity and right to a decent standard of living of each individual and give them opportunity at the same time to pursue fulfilling lives. It was especially nice to have this reassurance during a week when we saw the world around us seeming to be sliding distinctly back in the opposite direction. Just over a year ago, on August 18, 2017, I wrote about how our bubble of tranquility on the farm, our illusion of insulation from the ugliness of the world outside, was punctured by the events in Charlottesville, Virginia, the Unite the Right march that resulted in the death of one counter-protester. I published my father's drawing, made as a 12-year-old boy, of what he observed on Kristallnacht in Vienna, the unmistakable sign of the looming threat on the horizon. I wrote of my own sense of foreboding, post-Charlottesville. And as I said at the time, the foreboding did not derive principally from the events in Charlottesville themselves. We've seen in our lifetimes worse domestic terrorism from the likes of Timothy McVeigh. We've seen more explicitly racist violence like the Birmingham church bombings and the murder of the Mississippi Freedom Riders. We've seen the Nazis' taste for bold and threatening displays of power before, as when the party fought a long and successful legal battle in the late 1970s to march in Skokie, Illinois, a community full of Holocaust survivors. These elements will always be with us. Rather, I said at the time, the threat I sensed derived from the feeling that a major institutional bulwark against those ugly movements had been removed, that an important part of our government was switching sides. While we've had plenty of racism and nativism over the years, never in my lifetime have we had a president so disinclined to condemn those ideologies. Never in that time have we had a leader who treated opposition to racism as the moral equivalent of the racism itself. In resisting explicit condemnation of white supremacists until a pro forma statement was dragged out of him 2 days after the event last year, Mr. Trump let those purveyors of hate know that he had their backs. And then doubling back on Tuesday, the Tuesday that is of last year, after the events, to proclaim that there were very fine people among the brown shirts, he confirmed that he would be their champion as long as they loved him back. He has nurtured the seed of Nazism and guaranteed the future growth of an ugly cancer in our body politic. That's what I wrote then, and well, what do you know? It seems the seed has germinated, and the cancer has indeed grown. I can hardly claim unique prescience. Many others made the same prediction, now borne out. A single week of pipe bombs sent to the homes of former presidents and to others who had voiced opposition to Mr. Trump, of two African Americans being killed in and around one bubble of tranquility, a supermarket, and 11 Jews being killed in another bubble of tranquility, a synagogue, is all the evidence one needs. One of these incidents alone, in isolation, might be taken as just an example of a fringe person's troubled, aberrant break. But three episodes in 1 week, shortly before a midterm election that threatens, I pray, the white nationalist ascendancy, makes it a political social movement. A movement that, in place of recognizing the inherent and equal dignity of all, values us differently based on arbitrary characteristics of race, religion, national origin, and sexual orientation. Luckily, there is something we can all do in the coming days to help determine whether we're looking toward a future in which the dignity of every human being is recognized, or one in which the cancer of division and hate further metastasizes. We can vote. Please vote. This time the future really is at stake.
Agriculture is underwritten by Turkana Farms, LLC, a small-scale producer of heritage-bred livestock and a wide array of vegetables and berries on just over 39 acres in Germantown, New York. More information, 518-537-3815.